Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
On this episode of ID the Future, we're highlighting a clip from Jerusalem Post columnist Jonathan Rosenblum's recent lecture, Is Darwin Kosher? Here Rosenblum speaks to an audience at Discovery Institute about the way scientists approach their subjects with an ideological bias.
Now, an article that I've written called The Myth of Scientific Objectivity, one of those eight books that Bruce referred to that I wrote was on a figure, Rav Eliezer Dessler, considered perhaps the preeminent Jewish thinker of the first half of the 20th century, probably the most cited, most widely read. Now, Rabbi Dessler was a product of yeshivas in Lithuania. He came to England to recoup some business losses that his father had incurred and was then too old to try to recoup them himself. And he found himself tutoring a group of young boys. He gathered around him in London in that period of his life, young boys, many of them who were, they were all public school students, many of whom were scientifically inclined. One of them, Cyril Dahm, is now a fellow of the Royal Academy of Scientists, a leading physicist. And he dealt with them, and he dealt with all their questions that were raised, that they felt were raised by science, because certainly science has replaced what Aristotelian philosophy was for Maimonides. Science is for questioning, educated, Jewish and observant Jewish youth today. And he tried to answer their questions. One of the things that Rabbi Dessler emphasized, and I've talked to many of his students in the course of writing this book, many of whom went on to scientific careers, is he said, never forget, don't believe that the scientist is somehow objective. Because he has this great method, the scientific method. The method may be objective, and the method may be valid. And the testing of hypotheses and the data in terms of hypotheses and retesting and so forth and reformulating, there's nothing wrong with the scientific method. But don't be confuse science with the scientist or take every pronouncement that comes out of a scientist's mouth as if it is the definitive word of science, which is, as we will see, and I'll talk about a little more, is that that is one of the things that the Darwinians, the proponents of neo-Darwinian theory and so forth, claim the mantle of being all-knowing about all things. It is interesting, and Rabbi Joseph Beer Soloveitchik said, mostly knowledge makes people arrogant. The study of Torah is supposed to make people modest. The study of Torah is inherently an act of submission. It's an act of lessening oneself first in relation to previous generations. Every generation before ours is always looked at as a generation that's closer to the giving of Torah at Sinai. We are further removed from the essential revelation. In the one thing that's absolutely forbidden in Talmudic debate is to say, well, maybe they made a mistake. Even where they debate amongst themselves to say, well, this one just made a mistake. Or if I can't understand one of the commentaries from 800 years ago to say, well, this doesn't make any sense and therefore he's wrong and I'm right. You always start with that act of submission. One time, one of the great contemporary rabbis, Rav Aaron Cutler, gave a celebratory meal after he solved the problem in a commentator who was only 200 years in advance of him. And at the celebratory meal, he said, the only reason that I was worthy and privileged to ever solving and explaining what he meant and how he made this comment was not once in the 25 years that I worked on it did I ever think that the problem lay with Rabbi Akiva Eger. I knew the problem lay with me and with my understanding. The sense of humility with respect to the tradition which has been entrusted and passed on to you. That is something which is too frequently lacking from science today, from scientists, not science, but scientists. Rav Dessler, in a characteristic passage and the type of message that he passed on to his children, goes straight to the issue of scientific bias. And I think we'll see how that has implications for the debates which are raging around evolutionary theory as well. He invites his students, think of a person who, by the power of his intellect alone, wants to re-examine some fundamental problem, such as whether the world was created for a purpose. Let us assume that that person possesses a keen intellect, is well-educated, and well-informed. So far as his character is concerned, however, he is pretty average. He has never seriously tackled his moral failings. Now let us say that we're talking about a very comprehensive problem, the solution of which will determine whether he will be obliged to struggle constantly with his baser desires, or whether he will live with no restraints on his desires apart from those he deigns to place upon them. Can we seriously believe that he will arrive at a true conclusion merely by the exercise of his intellectual powers? In other words, can we seriously believe that the exercise of his intellectual powers will not be guided by his desire to live in a world in which there is no moral authority, he's not forced to struggle against his baser desires? That's not a small question. And insofar as that is implicated in the scientific work that he's doing, do we have to take him at his face value that he is an unbiased provider? William Provine, who's a historian of science at Cornell, provides a pretty good example of the scientist, the theoretical scientist or person being described by Rabbi Dessler, writing about evolution. He writes, "Second, modern science directly implies that there are no inherent moral or ethical laws." That's his conclusion. And I think perhaps the best treatment of this, or the best with which I'm familiar, is that of Philip Johnson, who makes no bones about it. Sometimes there are those who tend to blur the implications of Darwinian theory, and they say, well, Darwinian theory is dealing with one realm, the physically created world, and religion deals with another realm, which is removed from that. They don't clash because they're not dealing in a parallel universe. And Johnson shows to what degree that may be an artful treatment by some scientists who don't want to raise religious objections or don't want people to question their work. In some ways, it's an artful technique so that people don't question the authority of the scientist, to defer criticism, to say, no, we're dealing with different realms. That deals with moral realms. But in their realm, they're claiming a degree of knowledge and a degree with implications. Here, Provine is much more forthright. We in Israel appreciate the people who are forthright, who say exactly what's on their agenda. We've been very blessed with the Hamas movement, at least in one sense, who Hamas has been good enough to tell us that they aim to destroy us. And thank God that they're very honest, even when they've been given all kinds of rewards and offer of rewards to simply say they don't intend to wipe out the Jewish state. They continue to say, but we do intend to wipe out the Jewish state. That is our goal, and we will not amend our covenant, and we'll say it again in case you didn't hear it the first time. I mentioned on the radio this morning, I was delighted when the British Journalists Union voted to boycott Israel, since now at least they won't be able to claim that we have no bias, we have no dog in this fight there, that we don't have any bias in our reporting of what's going on in Israel. Very good. Let them vote to boycott Israel. Let them single out Israel from every other country in the world as the worst violator of human rights anywhere, and vote that journalists who are supposed to be objective and unbiased, let them indicate their biases as clearly as possible. So Provine here, I'm very grateful to say, and this is the implication that we find in this work, that there are no moral or ethical rules because the world that we know can be explained completely by mechanistic rules. Now, here's where I think, by the way, that Nathan Slifkin made a serious mistake. I think he was too credulous in his attempts to reconcile science and Torah and show that there are no inherent conflicts. I think, first of all, he took the science, and this is one of the criticisms that was raised. You take the science as a given. You take it as something that can't be questioned. If there's a consensus of scientific opinion on something, then that is the given, and we have to somehow match the Torah to the science, which those who were critical of him saw that as dangerous, but I think he was too credulous with respect to the science. He himself is on record in this Wall Street Journal article as dismissing the idea of intelligent design. He says, well, I think it even minimizes God. It creates God in the gaps. I think that's an unfair criticism. I don't think he really understands fully the science that's involved, or was too quick to accept an apparent scientific consensus. I think religious believers in general shouldn't be too quick to give up what they believe. You should understand that until 50 years ago, from the time of Aristotle until 50 years ago, it was absolute scientific consensus unanimity on the point of view of the eternity of the universe, which is, if you want to take something that was fundamentally irreconcilable to religion, is the idea of the eternity of the religion, of the universe, which was the antithesis of creation ex nihilo, me'ain, a creation from nothing, which is the biblical account of Genesis. If one thing that Genesis is certainly telling us is that God created the world and he created it from nothing. It's from that creation, by the way, that Maimonides, for instance, proved the incorporeal in some of his reinterpretation of biblical verses, some of which refer to parts of God, you know, as if he had a hand or an outstretched arm and so forth and so on. He says these are all metaphors. How do I know they are metaphors? Because the Torah tells us that God created ex nihilo. That means he was not on a par with that which was created. The creator was fundamentally different than the created it. Because otherwise you just get another question, well, who created God? Which is, I mean, you have to be an idiot to ask that question, though Richard Dawkins does ask that question and thinks he's very smart. But that idea of the creation from nothing. Until 50 years ago, there was an absolute consensus which was irreconcilable to the view of the Torah and the view of every other revealed religion. Until first there was a hypothesis of the Big Bang, and then there was a scientific evidence by two scientists working at the Bell Labs who came up with who discovered the radioactive emissions, which were evidence of that original Big Bang. And then there was empirical evidence to support the theory of creation. Now, interestingly, here you see a classic example of how scientific bias can affect the very greatest of scientists. I don't think anyone would deny that the greatest scientist of the 20th century, with the possible exception of Newton, the greatest scientist of all time was Albert Einstein. I mean, in 1906, he produced in 1 year three papers, each one of which was seminal. Not just that he should have won the Nobel Prize for all three of them, he didn't even win it for the theory of relativity, but in 1 year, he produced works which transformed science in at least three different areas. He was the greatest scientist. When confronted with the Big Bang theory, Einstein was first unwilling to accept it, and he made, in his attempt to disprove it, made elementary arithmetic mistakes, not complicated mathematics, arithmetic mistakes, then published in opposition to the Big Bang theory his refutation. Even a scientist as great as Albert Einstein, when something went against his received notions and his understanding of the world, could be led into fundamental, into basic arithmetic mistakes. We are not lacking today, and I think that of examples of where scientific consensus or where people consider to be the scientific consensus. I mean, a lot of things that we are presented with today as consensus, everybody believes that global warming is generated by human-produced carbon dioxide. I mean, usually they say everybody believes in global warming. Well, it's demonstrable over the last 100 years that there has been a slight increase in average temperatures around the globe. Where you go from there and what its causation is another matter. But everybody believes often means that the scientists have managed to convince the New York Times that this is the case and it's the end of debate. For the last 100 years, for instance, there was consensus among all the better people, the enlightened intelligentsia, Freudianism held sway, absolute sway, over Western intellectuals. Today, as one of my friends, my college roommate, now a psychoanalyst, said to me, if Freud were a growth stock, I don't think I would buy it. You find very few therapies. You may find insights from Freud used in therapies, but you find no therapies which are based, you don't find any attempts to empirically use scientific method to prove Freud, or you find, and increasingly therapy has all moved away from models based on Freud. I'm just giving you an example of something which everybody knew or which was so widely accepted, which today is no longer enjoys anything near that preeminence in the pantheon of ideas that it once did. So I think that is important. It's also important to understand how widespread, and we'll talk about the specific case of evolution, but how widespread is this attempt to close down debate among scientists, distinctly unscientific behavior? Because if there's one thing that should should characterize science, it is the openness to debate and counter evidence. I mean, Thomas Kuhn in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions points out millions of disparate facts can be raised, and until an alternate theory comes apart, people will continue to hold to the existing theory until another paradigm presents itself, no matter how many divergent facts there are. That's how new paradigms come into existence. Until that paradigm comes into existence, the theory is held on to with a great degree of determination. I'm sort of reminded of a statement by a character in one Tom Stoppard play who says, if a person's bright enough, you can convince him of about anything. And to some extent, I would say that this applies as well to the questions that are raised about evolutionary theory, the neo-Darwinian hypothesis. It's David Berlinsky, who's a fellow of the Discovery Institute, wrote in one of his incredible articles and commentary, he said, the evolutionists would like you to think that everything is agreed upon, everything is understood. It's only when you turn out the lights that you find out they become rather feral with respect to one another. When the lights are out and they think nobody's looking, then they really go after each other. I mean, everybody knows the leading popularizer of our time of evolutionary theory is, besides Dawkins, Stephen Gould. But Stephen Gould was anathema in his lifetime to many a leading evolutionist because he broke completely on one central point. Darwin said, if you'll give me saltations, if you'll give me major changes in the structures and major changes, not the accumulation of slight changes over a period of time, that's a refutation of my theory. Gould said you can't get away from it. The fossil record dictates that. And he came up with all kinds of theories. And many others who confronted with problems in evolutionary theory of great scientists, leading scientists, said the mathematics is impossible, so therefore we have to believe in the saltations, which Darwin himself said would be fundamentally irreconcilable with his theory. You find many cases in which a degree of consensus is indicated, but it's not really there. One of the things that commentary talked about not so long ago on the issue of global warming, how did the Danish Academy of Science react to Bjørn Lomborg, somebody who published a study in which he said whatever the impact of human-produced carbon dioxides on global warming, the efforts to remove that would be so catastrophic economically with the money that it would cost. You could cure all the malaria in the world. There was no consideration of what are the economic trade-offs and how that money might be spent and what other things could be done. You have only the most catastrophic presentations of everything. The oceans will rise 14 feet, sweeping all before them, and the world will enter into a new flood. Instead of an attempt to, anybody who raised this, there was an attempt to silence him. The attempt wasn't to debate him. The attempt was to silence him. There was not an attempt because, and there is in this debate, as in so many others, a heavy ideological component. It's interesting how often you see people who are the most catastrophic with respect to global warming, like they once were with respect to population explosion. I mean, don't forget, there was a book everybody read in 1968 called The Population Bomb, and everybody, billions of people would die in America, not just in the world, in America would be dead by the 1980s out of mass starvation because population was growing too quickly. Nothing like that ever happened. All Darwinian theory is based on Malthus, and Malthus has been refuted for over 150 years. I mean, these things, but there was always a bias in there. The bias was people are bad. People are screwing up the world. The world would be a fine place if they would just get rid of people, if we would just impose strict limits on population control, get rid of Catholics, get rid of Orthodox Jews, take care of all these renegade groups and got rid of all the people, the world would be fine. And then also in addition, there's also another nice benefit because once you have such a catastrophe on our side, then all those who really don't believe in democratic government and realize that in a catastrophic situation, you have to turn over rule to the better educated, the elite, those who understand the real problem and know what to solve. So now the scientist becomes the demigod. He's not just telling you a particular theory. He's now the person who you have to turn to. What is the solution to our problem? Tell us what the solution to the problem is. You've turned by the emphasis on the, that's another way in which scientific bias comes into the equation. by the desire of the scientist to turn himself into the repository of knowledge, not only the repository of identifying a particular process, but now I will have the solution. You have to turn to me for the solution. Regulation is necessary. The populace cannot be trusted to figure out how we can confront this. The catastrophe confronting us is too great. We have to impose a solution from above. And in which process the scientist will always be at the top person. Another one of the ideological biases, which as Provine already mentioned, is the desire to portray man as indistinct, as absolutely indistinct from the animals. I mean, that is what Simpson is saying when he says he's a product of an evolutionary process, a mechanistic process, which did not have him in mind. Man is one product. Animals are another product. Among those who, the devotees of evolutionary theory, they always want to expand it into ever new realms, sociobiology, evolutionary biology, whatever you want to call it, is always this hostility to man, the idea that man is different. Peter Singer, who's written articles published recently in the Jerusalem Post, an article in which he argued that you can prove that all religious belief, all moral belief, is also an evolutionary adaptation. And how do you prove that? Well, if you ask people around the world, if you have a choice between saving a baby from falling over the Niagara Falls, but you might get your pants wet, what should you do? And amazingly, 90% of the people in the world think that it'd be worth it to get your pants wet rather than let the baby go over Niagara Falls. So that degree of consensus demonstrates that there's only one possible explanation for that, which is that there must be some evolutionary reason behind that. So you see that all our moral beliefs are evolutionary. That is what passes. This is seriously, I mean, Peter Singer is an endowed chair in ethics at Princeton. He was written in conjunction with a Harvard professor. This is what passes for science. These are, if you can find a consensus on this question, they only asked three questions. On this question, then you've demonstrated that people think alike, and if people think alike, there can be only one explanation. That explanation must be that it's a product of an evolutionary process. So if he's a product of an evolutionary process, he's just another animal, which has a number of implications. First of all, Singer takes it to the extreme. He says all our prescriptions on bestiality should be done away with. He hasn't quite worked out the consent problem with respect to the animal partner, but I don't even know if he recognizes it as a problem, but he's a fanatic on animal rights. On the other hand, he says among the views, if you ask me what views will no longer have any place in the intellectual horizon in 25 years, he told the New York Times, one of them I would say the idea of the sanctity of human life. And in fact, he's lectured frequently and is an enthusiastic proponent of euthanasia, of a person's not right but duty to shuffle off this mortal coil when he gets to 70 years old, that he might be using up too much of the resources. This idea that man is just another animal, in the example that Rav Dessler gives, that's what we're talking about. Somebody who says, there's no reason to try and control my baser impulses, because all these impulses, whether good or bad, altruistic or not, they're all evolutionary, they're product of an evolutionary process. And I'm not forced to struggle with this. After all, animals do everything by instinct. Whatever I'm doing is a reflection of my instinct. I look a little bit different, but that only gives me a certain greater ability to solve my needs or to create new needs and to find new ways of satisfying those needs. But it doesn't make me fundamentally different than an animal. This is, as I said before, implicit in all the sociobiological thinking, which are people who are basing themselves on Darwin. That the genes, I mean, this is an amazing theory. Sometimes you just have to sit back and listen to the evolutionist talk with the idea of common sense. I mean, this is one of the things that Philip Johnson did in his book, Darwin on Trial, is say, I'm not a scientist. I'm a professor of law. I'm actually a professor of evidence. My study is the study of arguments, to try and figure out how arguments are made and to find out how they're credible. And sometimes if you just listen with a commonsensical view, I mean, there's an Australian philosopher by the name of David Stove who wrote a book called Darwinian Fairy Tales, which is mostly a refutation of Dawkins and Dawkins' discussion of sociobiology. According to Dawkins, the whole world is based, genes seek to, and this is E.O. Wilson at Harvard, genes seek to propagate themselves. Every genetic means, the real secret of the universe is genes seeking to create other genes to propagate themselves further. And everything that you see in human life is just an example of that. So one scientist predicted, he predicted that if a person could save two half-relatives who share his gene pool, in that case, he might give up his own life because it would have a net advantage for his gene pool, but not in the terms of further removed relatives, about which Stove said, I don't really believe this for a very simple reason. I'm not an idiot. Because has any proposition ever been advanced which is so more readily capable of empirical refutation? Throughout history, people have given up their lives for those who have share no common gene pool, and there are many people who have refused to give up their lives for two people who may share half of their gene pool or three people who may share half of their gene pool. If this theory were correct, incest would be almost would be mandated by almost every human society, and it's taboo in every known human society because nothing would further the development of a particular gene pool. As he says, they in their place, in their eagerness to remove God, I mean, Dawkins, who's famously said, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. But they've turned genes into the new gods. Genes never disappear. They always go on. They propagate themselves. They find new ways of going on, like Dawkins taught. And they're imbued with a degree of intelligence and intention which the greatest engineer is not imbued with. In other words, Dawkins describes a certain cuckoo bird which plants an egg in another bird's nest, which that bird thinks is its own egg, and then sits upon it, and it uses the other bird to warm its eggs. What a clever way to advance its own gene pool. It's discovered a means of disguising its egg and getting another bird to lay on it. I mean, who would ever be able to come up with that? But the genes are all-knowing, all-powerful, all-thinking, and they can do everything. They're given all the intention with God. There's no intelligent designer. There's no manifestation of design in the world. But the genes, they can plan out things. They can go on.
That was an excerpt from Jonathan Rosenblum's Discovery Institute lecture, Is Darwin Kosher? For ID the Future, this is Annika Smith from the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.